multimodal type research. So if you have any questions about analyzing, assessing, what does it mean, all these kinds of questions, these are the people to ask Mary at Work in the Field. We're going to start minutes. We told everybody, you know, the finish time quarter after. Although, thanks to the class who came at 2, I thought I had to put that false, time in. And we will finish, students in Kazakhstan, half an hour before. And also, we're missing a bunch of participants, so if you guys want to move in closer, I mean, there are two. If you notice, there's two sets of screens. There's Finnish language screens, and then there's English language. So, it's a multilingual. Do you want to go up here, or do you want to sit up in there? Oh, look at you. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, wow. Okay, you guys are... That's really cool. Yes. And Kate also has a lot of material that she'll be handing around so you get an idea of what that means and how to utilize it.
So welcome everybody. What I'm mostly going to talk about is the work that I've been doing over a 10-year period in Rotherham. And a lot of these projects are accompanied by artifacts. And these artifacts are the books and the things that have been written about the project by the participants. So with our projects, we co-wrote and co-participated in the research, including the children. And one of the things I'm now reflecting on is after kind of doing a long-scale project like that, is what that feels like to actually co-produce a project. So what I've got are lots of things. I'm going to send them round, but I will be referring to them. So what would be good is at various points if we just paused and made sure people had a chance to look at them. And we'll start by handing them round, and then at one point I'll start referring to them. So that's as a kind of starting point of what I'm doing. But it's so that everybody gets a chance to have a look. and do keep passing them around. So my talk is about collaborative ethnography and co-production in schools and community settings. And I suppose one of the things about my work is I started in a particular place and then I moved. So I started in one place and went to another place. And one of the reasons that I changed is that I changed how I thought because of the community research team that I worked with. So my interests originally were on literacy and language practices in communities. I was interested in material and multimodal literacies as lived and embodied. I was interested in co-production with children and young people, using collaborative ethnography and arts methodologies. But my vision for realising this, and I think this is why we're all here with Nettie as well today, is through university community collaboration. So I thought that all these things that I was interested in, I couldn't do just within a university. That actually a university can't produce knowledge on its own, and the knowledge within the university is not necessarily enough for what I was interested in researching. So I started with a conceptual framework that identified writing, language, and culture as terms that could be identified within the shifting sands of observation. So I would see these things like writing, language, and culture. And in the beginning of my work, work as an academic, I very much drew on my field notes, texts that I collected by young people, films that they made, artifacts that they made, interviews that we did together, discussions and conversations and group projects and school projects. So I started by doing something that was quite recognisable as research. But what I've done now and where I've finished was in a space where writing singly about those phenomena was much less possible because the people that I was researching with became the co-researchers on the teams that I was working with. So the ownership of concepts and ideas in research thinking on literacy and language became shared and co-constructed, which is why the publications are so important. In my original research, I considered the ways in which literacies were inscribed within textiles, carried across from home to school on bus journeys, and they were enacted in playground leaps and became material and immaterial in relation to online and offline practices. So I started just to kind of, no, don't worry. I'll just explain where I've gone. So you've only missed two slides. And the only slide was this, which was where I started. This was where I began. And then this idea of where I ended up, which is that I had co-owned concepts of language. And I think when you co-own a conceptual framework around language, it's really hard to make sense of language and literacy according to the disciplinary structures that we're given in universities. And I think that's what I'm really struggling with at the moment, is the ways in which we've, as a group of academics, constructed what literacy and language is, are not adequate for what happens when you're sitting in a playground with a group of children. It looks so different. And so that's really one of my issues. So when I started out, I thought about the ways in which literacies were inscribed within textiles, carried across from home to school on bus journeys, enacted in playground leaps, and became material and immaterial in relation to online and offline practices. So I was always interested in this kind of wide landscape, homeschool. I never really divided the digital from the non-digital. I thought they were all meshed together. And I was interested in those in-between spaces like bus journeys. I was also interested in materiality like textiles, where there were things written into textiles, bits of script. So it was a very broad lens. And this is an image from some of my research projects. The one on the right is of a Union Jack, and I'll just sit down in case I'm in the way, but it was produced in 2016 as part of a project which was looking at hope, and it was produced in an area called Eastwood in Rotherham with a group of Roma heritage and Pakistani heritage young women. And it's a very positive moment in that it talks about things like, I think it was just before the Brexit vote, it talks about the London Olympics, it talks about Pakistan, it has a lot of images that are very dear to the young people. Rihanna's so great. And the sort of the bits of culture that make a kind of hybrid space for those young people, a positive hybrid space. This is a Lift the Flap book, which was done by two teenagers in a library, which was repurposed for teenagers. They thought Lift the Flap was too fun to be just for toddlers. And so it says, does money make you happy or sad? Lift the flap to say no or yes. That's from an image collected by a 10-year-old in a home of her purse, and it has lots of stickers to indicate keep out and top secret. And that was a film made by young people, which was given to the government of the UK, civil service, that they never actually watched. But it was about young people's representation and listening practices in communities. And they said, they would have shown you our faces, but as young people, we feel we're nothing but shadows to the government. And this is a project called Portals to the Past, which was devised by an artist I work with quite a lot called Steve Poole. And a lot of these projects had artists kind of enmeshed within them. And I were very, very caught up with artistic ideas as well as being about ethnography. So from where I started to where I went next is my understandings changed in relation to the collaborations and conversations that developed. And I do think a lot of my time is spent having conversations. As the methodologies became entwined within co-researchers and community participants' understandings of literacy. So while I began in this quite traditional way, with the field notes, collected texts and ethnographic observations, I was changed actually by this book. So this book changed my life. You know, you talk about life-changing books. I was working in Rotherham, which at that time was quite a difficult community. It had a lot of bad press about sexual exploitation, and it also had a lot of street racism. The people who wrote this book were Eric Lasseter, Beth Campbell, and Hurley Goodall, and a group of community researchers. And it was about a town called Middletown, actually Muncie, Indiana, which had been researched by a group of anthropologists in the 30s. But they only researched the white community. And the African-American community, which also was part of Muncie, Indiana, came to the university and said, we want to tell our story, but we don't want the academics to do the research. We want to do the research. So they actually devised the project and they actually did the writing of the book themselves. Now, this was a massive shift. So rather than me write, in our project, the Imagine Project, the communities wrote. So somewhere the book that we wrote is going around. Has who's got the book? Can someone wave it? Wave it. Reimagining contesting communities. So that was written by everybody in the project that we did. So that changed my life. That's my life-changing moment. So I turned to collaborative ways of working in which participants became researchers. And they devised and conducted projects that then articulated emergent conceptualizations of literacy. And this is what I'm still working on, is how do we think about literacy through the eyes of not us in our disciplinary boundaries? I turned from a model where I took data from a field to one where I learned from the field alongside a team of community researchers. So this is a quote from my colleague Zainab Rasool, who couldn't come here today because she's too busy, I think. But she has written an article in Research for All about this idea of knowledge. And we talked to Nettie talked about knowledge production this morning. After 30 years of working in the community, I advocate the view that everybody holds the key to knowledge. It can be found in every community and every house in the land, although we put different value on that knowledge. People in our communities have life experiences and cultural experiences. Through this, they acquire their own knowledge base, and we should not disregard this when we work with communities. Through this project, we were able to celebrate funds of knowledge. So somebody, there should be a pamphlet called Herbal Medicine. If somebody waves that. So that was, as part of our project, the Imagine Project, Zainab set up, it's the beige one. She set up a project with a group of women in the school where she was working. And it was just after we'd had a lot of media reports about Rotherham not being friendly to girls and women, and we thought we'd look at what knowledge women had. And the group of women in this school decided to write that book. So it was their contribution to our project, which was about herbal remedies. It's quite useful, but I should read it because I've got a cold at the moment. So this is a portrait by one of the artists. We commissioned Zahir Rafiq, who was an artist on the project we were doing, to do a series of portraits of British Muslims. And this is a picture of his mother, and it's his mother's material shop in Eastwood in Rotherham. And it's actually really comes home to me, this idea of materiality, but also material knowledge and the vibrancy of that knowledge. So this was commissioned as part of the Imagine Project. I guess one of the things that I've always been interested in, and I know Nettie's work has really reflected, is this idea of artifactual literacies. And this idea of literacy being densely patterned, woven through with stories, seeped in material artifacts and layered through intergenerational conceptual framings. So this is one of the things I did when I was working in Rotherham, was have an understanding of literacy that was inscribed into material objects. But an artifactual literacy approach widened the scope of how literacy was understood by linking literacy to material situated cultures. So it's that linking between I was also doing in my work. So this is a quote from an interview I did with a young person called Alia. Now, I first interviewed Alia when she was 10, and this is actually, I think it's not quite 10 years, it was more like when she was 17, I revisited the interview. And she was talking to me about her literacy practices at home. And she talked about this candle poem called A Candle of My Thoughts. And she was trying to explain what the poem was. And she said, I used to share a room with my grandmother. Sorry, is it working out?
For some reason, I have a very incomplete finished version.
Oh.
But you do continue. I'll try to find the complete.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, it's not your fault.
I don't mind going really slowly for people. I used to share a room with my grandmother before I moved here, and we used to bicker. So she used to tell me stories to mellow me down a bit. She used to tell me all sorts of stories, religious stories about my grandfather, about relatives, and it would be like bedtime stories to get me to sleep. And she taught me a special prayer, which I still read to this day, three times. So this is faith literacies, actually. So it protects the household from any spirits or anything happening while we are sleeping. Sleep peaceful. I was 4 years old when I learned that, yes. So for the past 13 years, I've been reading that. This is a wonderful account of a literacy practice, but it's also a very real notion of the candle and the idea of the candle held the prayer. And we co-wrote a chapter, which is actually out now, In the book by Julian Sefton Green and Jennifer Rousel called Learning Literacy Over Time, Longitudinal Perspectives. But our piece was co-written. And in that piece, we had different voices about what we understood to be literacy. And one of the things Alia said is that literacy for her was about her mother and her grandmother. It was intergenerational and it was female. So again, there were different perceptual frameworks about how we saw literacy. And that really, so that was one of my first co-writing experiences. And one of the things that we wrote about in the book, Reimagining Contested Communities, is moving from this idea of collecting literacies to living literacies. And this is actually the title of my next book with Jennifer Rousel, Living Literacies. But I think this idea of literacies as lived is very significant. So in our book, we were talking about the way literacy looks different wherever you look in the data. These competing analyses were also collaboratively constructed and reflexively analysed. So one of the things we did is, drawing on Eric Laster and Elizabeth Campbell's work, we co-analysed our data. We didn't just sit with it in our team, research university team. We met with everybody and co-analysed that. The literacies were lived and experienced with people, and the construction of the data was produced in experience and within sites and spaces. This was not a model of research that took data from a site, but instead produced it within a site as a co-production. Is it back?
It's back.
Yes! Do you want me to go back?
No worries. I think everyone understood.
Are you sure? If you didn't understand, put your hand up. But if anyone's lost, is anyone lost? Are they all fine?
There's if you can read quickly and finish if you want to. Here's my excellent translations.
So this is, shall I go back?
If you want to, yeah, of course. Yeah.
But I don't want to muddle people up. Yeah, does everyone understand? Does anyone want me to go back again?
Raise
your hand if you want me to go back. Because I don't like people not understanding.
Okay, we're on the same page.
The co-production process included co-analysis and co-inquiry. As projects were developed in collaboration with community researchers such as Zainab Rasool. So Elizabeth Campbell, who was involved in The Other Side of Middletown, was the lead co-author for the Reimagining Contested Communities book. The other thing we did is someone got the Blue Imagine booklet, little blue booklet. Wave it in your hand. Yeah, so that was a 3-day residential at the end of the project where we all worked out what we'd learnt. And again, that was co-produced with the whole community that was involved in the project. So to move on to my idea of living literacies, I guess one of the things that I began with is this idea from Himes on voice and power. And I still think, I really echo what Lindsay said this morning, is that we have to really pay attention to the inequalities our participants are involved in. In the projects that I work in, the young people come from communities which are not easy to live in. They're not easy to just get up in the morning and get to school in. And lots of things happen in the communities that are really quite difficult. We need to focus on voice and power in our data and who has the power. I'm also really interested in local spaces and the idea of the sites and spaces of literacy being specific. And I still go back to David Barton and Mary Hamilton's idea of local literacies and domains of literacy. So going back to the idea of faith literacies, I think we don't pay enough attention to where people are doing literacy and for what purpose. But we particularly don't look at those in between spaces. Teenagers travel across like buses. I do think we should do more on buses. And someone called Bryce Norquist is writing about the New York subway really interestingly. Artifactual literacies I still don't want to lose sight of. From the new materialism into the artifactual, I think there's still quite a lot to be explored there. I'm still recovering and thinking about ideological literacies from Brian Street's account. But then our new framework, which is, you first here, heard it here, for the new book, is looking at literacy as lived through these optics of seeing, knowing, hoping, disrupting, creating, and making. And that's really my new kind of understanding of literacy, which is a much more active one because it was co-produced with the participants that I was working in. So just to describe a little bit about the Imagine Project. Am I all right for time?
Yep.
Oh, good. The Imagine Project was we literally sat in a room together in 2011. It was funded for 5 years, and it was funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. It was part of something called the Connected Communities Programme, which encouraged people to put in bids. In fact, it said all bids had to be written with communities. So we couldn't just write a bid in the university and then say, oh, can you do this with us? We weren't allowed to do that. When we put the bid in, it had 50 letters of support. It's a nightmare, though, co-producing. I've just had to co-produce another bid. And literally, you are on the phone the whole time saying, you know the thing you said you'd do? Can you write it in your letter of support, please? Because it really needs participants to do a lot of work. And increasingly, you do need to pay those participants. So with our project, we paid the participants the same, the researchers in the community, the same as the university partners, which drove the university partners mad, but the participants did loads more work. I think it was about £6,000 they got. So it's quite a lot, a significant amount of money, and they ran their own research projects. So they came up with the ideas such as Silk and Steel, Reimagining the Future, Portraits of British Muslims. They were given the same financial support. So as I said, £6,000, that's a lot of money, but we took our community research team really seriously. We also funded Time for Writing, so everybody was funded to be part of the writing retreat. Meetings was held to set up the discussions and co-write the book, and oral storytelling was used. So some of those chapters were transcribed oral storytelling in the book. So that's Zainab, and that's Mariam Shah. It was Ramadan, Rotherham, June 2017. We held our conference in Rotherham. We invited quite a lot of quite distinguished academics, including a quant academic, and a group of Maori academics from New Zealand who came over and talked about the idea of basket of knowledge. And that shifted our community research team's understanding of what they knew. They really loved that idea. And I think part of it was recognising what people know and not being afraid of that. So if someone wants to hold up the book again, where's the book got to now? No, the actual, this one, yeah. So if you look at that book, there is a huge amount of people in it, including two people who worked for the local the government civil service, wrote in the book. It was a horizontal writing structure, so all the voices were important. We included artists and poets, so Shaheen Shah, Zahir Rafiq, Cassie Lim, Nathan Gibson, Ray Hearn and Ryan Bradley had equal weight in the book. We also had a lot of about history. Our participants said that British local history groups tended to be very white. They didn't tend to research the history of the communities that, like Pakistani heritage community, the Roma heritage community, so they wanted to redo local history. Parents wrote about what it was really like to be a parent. There's a lovely chapter in there by a group of parents in Rotherham, including Abby Hackett, but and parents who are just local parents, about how tired you get as a parent and just wanting to lie on a sofa. And then the Children's Centre took away the sofa. I love that chapter. Young people did a lot of images in the book, which are in there, about their Rotherham, and they wrote poems. And we also had a lot of multimodal representations. So what are the implications for this kind of projects that I'm telling you for research? I think we need to find ways of breaking down barriers and respecting everyday knowledge. I think that there is knowledge within communities. We've done a lot of work around history. I think history is really important. People who come to places have histories. And I mean, just at lunchtime, I was talking with Vicky about her intergenerational family history, and I was thinking every person who comes here to Finland should have the opportunity to tell their stories, but also that history is actually what you carry, and actually to come to another country means erasing your history often, and that's really one of the best things I did recently was watch Doctor Who on partition of India. And you know, it is really important that people understand that history. There are a huge population in the UK, Pakistani heritage communities. So I think this idea of the past, present, future, the skills within communities, including fishing, we've done a project on fishing, sewing, languages and cultures. I think languages are very, very important as modes of knowledge. The understanding that there are different ways of representing knowledge, visually, spatially, orally, but also learning to listen differently, which might mean giving up what you want to do. And that's the hardest part, is literally not doing what you want to do. So this is a quote from our UK civil service head of policy and integration. And I was just so happy when they wrote this piece in our book. The mission of collaborative ethnography is to bring the academic research endeavour closer to communities and to generate knowledge together which is more authentic, representative, and negotiated with communities. The questions of whose knowledge and who speaks for whom is an issue that should be asked of all research, and indeed all knowledge claims. In this book, we can see an emerging parity in the status of the different voices and knowledge presented. So this is a slide that Zainab did, but I really like it. We gave this slide to the Department of Community, DCMS, the Sport, Heritage and Culture, in January. This kind of research allows communities that have been disempowered to renegotiate their boundaries that have been set by others and challenge public discourses. Communities are never static, they're evolving, and cohesion is happening all around us at a micro level, which questions the parallel lives discourse, but it remains invisible. I think that's really interesting as a kind of counter to Lindsay's thing about the ways in which children practice microaggressions of racism. One of the things Zainab and I tried to look at is we looked at micro positive things in Rotherham, and they were really interesting. They were very nuanced, and they weren't necessarily very visible, but there were ways in which we could identify those. Arts methodologies is a powerful tool in capturing those changes. So one of the things we did in our most recent project, has anyone got Taking Yourself Seriously, that booklet? No, there's that one, and then there's another one. No, there's a book of by a group of children. Yeah, that one. So that one, that was a school in Rotherham with a third Pakistani, third Roma, and third white, and they were looking at social cohesion. They researched arts methodologies for social cohesion, and the children found that their musical community brought them together. They did a lot of music together, and that's where they were able to find ways of having conversations across cultural spaces. But the key thing for Zainab and for many of the community partners, including the children who did that book, is authoring and writing the book themselves gave us ownership over the process of reimagining contested communities. So rather than it be... So Zainab's book is about three generations of Muslim women, but it really was her project. It wasn't mine. I didn't actually go to the meetings, except possibly once. She ran that whole project. She was a community co-investigator on an AHRC project. So I think that repositioning was really, really important. Collaborative methodologies recognise that all participants, regardless of training credentials or situations, possess valid forms of knowledge and expertise. Collaborative methodologies ask researchers to work alongside research participants to co-produce knowledge that's mutually accessible and relevant. Embracing the actual human relationships at the centre of collaborative research opens all who participate to the possibility of being changed by each other. And I think that idea of it's being relational, I've been thinking a lot about the relational nature of knowledge and how, and the co-constructed nature of it in those spaces. That's the book. And I've got some questions for you. There's some references. But I just thought what we could do is actually have a conversation now. And also, if people want to comment on any of the books that are going around, because they're really the subject of the talk, but I couldn't really put them in the talk. I thought it'd be best if you handled them in an artifactual way and made sense of them. So I hope that's helpful. But we can now have a discussion. These are just some prompts, but you can. What I was going to do is get you to do this in groups and then feedback. But Nettie, it's up to you what we do next. I've just been in Seville, and I asked them to do this. And what I asked them to do is to talk for about 2 minutes to your neighbour about one of these questions, and then maybe feedback. So rather than have random questions, although we could have random questions, I thought we could ask these questions. But we could talk in pairs and then maybe feed them back, or feedback as questions, so that everybody has a chance to have a little think and maybe ask a question or two. So do you want to talk to the person next to you for 5 minutes? You could start with the question number one, but you can move through if you want. Yes, so who do you think, whose voices count in collaborations?
Ideally, everybody's voices.
Yeah,
I think.
But then how do we incorporate them in research? Do you want to have it and then can pass it around?
Yeah, I can have it.
Yeah.
Is it on?
Yeah, it's on.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
How do we incorporate diverse voices? like, how do you in practice incorporate the voices? That's a bit trickier. I'd say, like, collaborative writing in addition to, like, research.
That's why that's why I've argued that. That's why I'm why I'm essentially arguing that the collaborative writing is where that happens. Because at least it acknowledges their voice. is that I know that some people from the multimodal class are here, and I want to explain that for me, this talk is about multimodality, because I guess one of the discussions that we're having is what is our boundary around what literacy is? And if you do something collaboratively, it makes it more multimodal. So one of the things that's happening with all those books going around is they're all very image-based. And that's quite an interesting issue to do with language and where language sits. So even the book, we had to fight to get all those pictures in. So from the multimodal point of view, there's a discussion about equity and how multimodality creates a more equitable space. So although I know it's not completely about multimodality, I think there is something actually quite important in my argument. So if you go back to the images here of what literacy is, the images are very multimodal. And I think that's what I really wanted to talk about, that literacy was inscribed into these. And also, you said a really clever thing. What was your clever thing?
What was my clever thing?
You did!
Should I speak on the mic? Or?
Okay. What I said is that learning from the project that I've been working on with Nettie is that I think in many school contexts, we see literacy as something that has to be taught by someone. Instead, what it really can be is that it's a process that is like learned collaboratively. It's not a product of anything. It's not a skill that you learn, but it's more about the working together in creating something. But the product is not the main idea.
Yeah, and I think those two ideas, to hold on to those, this idea of the multimodality and the literacy as process is really what came out of the research that I did. So let's hear from the groups. Should we go around with the microphone? Because the key question, I guess, in this set of questions is how do we incorporate diverse voices in research? But how does literacy look different? So it'd be really good to hear from everybody. And also, if people do have a question for me as well, but I'd love to hear from what people discussed about.
And also, just stemming from what you said in terms of multimodality and how do we frame literacy, it's also the point that they're making is really important, because you're given a group project or you're given a task where you have to assess the product. But really, you have to think about how you analyze the product as what is the process they're going through and what perspectives are they trying to show, not what end product are we trying to show. So we have to understand that when we're looking at something that's multimodal, the sound, everything must be assessed on different levels and then integrated, you know, kind of thing. So we think of it as, like you were saying, there's meaning embedded in everything, sound, sight, thing. And there are different meanings and there are different voices. Because it's not one person that makes the product. It's a collaborative group effort. And does anyone else have... Actually, you had a really important thing that I... We were talking about co-production, and...
Whose role? Okay. So we were discussing... Is this working, though?
It's weird. It doesn't seem to work.
Sorry. Yeah, thank you. We were discussing a couple of the points that you brought up around the time... That's in order for diverse voices to be incorporated, the importance of the time in actually setting up those relations.
Well,
can you not hear?
We
were talking about the time that it takes to set up, to kind of develop those relationships and to build those relationships. And I was giving an example of a project that we've developed that actually has, in some cases, about 14 or 15 years worth of.
Yeah.
Relationships kind of threaded into the project as a kind of way of bringing things together in a different way. And also wondering how that can be valued in a institutional context. And as you said, cases where you want to divert funding to these organizations who in many cases need this funding very much, and their contribution should be valued, but that's always extremely difficult to negotiate. So the time and the funds.
It's so important. And there's the UK government's just published a report called The Common Cause. It's the HRC's report, actually, which is talking about universities' relationship to black and ethnic minority organisations. And there's something about an ethics of care there. And actually, again, the co-planning. It all does take a huge amount of time. And actually, I've just been a victim of this because I've moved from Rotherham and Sheffield to Manchester. And most recently, I've begun to go out into communities and just listen. And I sat in Salford, it's actually called Salford Lads Club, but with a group of girls the other day. And I just thought, wow, I've got another 10 years to learn about Salford. And I sat with another youth worker group. And it feels like you start literally from scratch, but you also have to trust that people will think you're all right. Because I kind of sat there thinking, what do they think I'm doing? But I just said, I want to help you in any way I can. I think part of it is saying to them, what can the university do to help? So whether it's offering widening participation or offering some money, which you can go away and get, it's like, how can the university help? And I guess it's that open offer rather than saying, what can we get? Which I think is probably a problematic thing to do. But I still am very conscious of how you have to rebuild. And I went back to Rotherham recently and saw Zainab and gave a presentation to their Empowering Communities team, and they loved it. But that's taken a long time to get to that point. It's a huge issue. Let's hear from all the little groups.
So what did everybody discuss in their groups?
What did you guys discuss?
So what did we discuss? So we discussed that, for instance, I have done research with children, like the presentations in the morning, and we were discussing I have some videos created by children, and so in a way then their voices get, so their stories of their communities get told through those videos, so that's the way they kind of participate. Then of course we were discussing that if we could pay our participants the same way as, but then with children it's different, so in a way we thought that they have found the activities meaningful and not like, something they had to do because they are at school, and in school you have to do a lot of things, so they were actually voluntarily participating and they had fun while doing it, so in that way they were considered as kind of equal or taken seriously, if you wish. So that was...
I like the idea of taking them seriously. And the Taking Yourself Seriously project, which I think somebody's got the leaflet of, the children were given the choice of whether to go or not to the research team group meeting. And I think that choice thing is really important, and giving children choice. We'll talk about ethics tomorrow, but I've been experimenting with ethics on my new project. I've got a new project called Feeling Odd in the World of Education, in which I gave out information sheets and consent forms to children. I got them in groups, but I really encouraged them to say no, because one of the things that I worked with a youth worker on the project this project, he said to me, can you encourage the girls to say no? And the reason is we'd had a lot of child sexual exploitation in that area, and it was really good for the girls to say no to adults, but also, it was really interesting because what they did is they said, the line that says, I'm happy to be written about in articles, they all went, well, what's an article? And when they found out, we said it's in a journal and it's really hard to read, they said no. And then we had a long, long discussion. In the afternoon, they did do some work. And then they came up to me and they said, we've signed these bits of paper, which was some of their work. You can have that for the project. So they were really specific, but I think we haven't written this up yet, but we're really thinking about it. It made me realise that we really have to give young people the choice of actually saying no to being in our research projects. That means we have to figure out what to do when they do say no. It drove my project team mad. They're still furious with me because I've actually stopped them doing research. But actually what's really good is the young people have said no, and we've actually had an experience with them that is theirs and ours and shared and genuine without having... I remember there was a moment when they were showing their stuff, and Steve, who I was working with, said, shall I video? And they said no. So we haven't got anything to show.
And we actually had the same incident in the rap session where, because they were a certain age, they were 13-year-old girls, and suddenly a friend had created a song, and it was very personal about her life.
and the friend had given permission originally, and then changed their mind and said, no, you can't rap my song. So we're like, ah! So we had to start from scratch, and we had to create. But it was okay that she said no, because that's her personal...
Because that's her personal, it was her song. And at that age, at 13, that's a really tender age. So we just kind of went, okay, well, that's cool. And, you know, we can, that's fine. And so you have to, like, get rid of the data and just continue on. But, yeah, I think that's a very good point when you're working.
I'm actually just about to write something about no. Any other discussions from the other groups?
Other groups?
Thank you. So we kind of talked about how does literacy look different when you draw on the different participants' ideas. And we said that, of course, it depends on individual level. So each participant's going to have a different idea. But when you bring them all together, you have so many different, you know, views and visions and rankings of which literacy is most important. So some people might rank oral literacy as more important than written literacy, or, you know, what even styles. Like you were talking about faith literacy. There are some people who don't have much use for faith literacy, where there's also other people who really rank that pretty high. So I think it really depends on an individual level. And we also kind of talked about the incorporation of diverse voices in research, didn't we? And we kind of got this idea that that's really up to the researcher. It's the researcher's job to kind of make sure that all these diverse voices are incorporated. And that's something that a lot of academics usually forget about themselves, is that they have a role to kind of support the community, to bring the community in, to elevate the community in a way. And so I hate to put the onus on you, but it's really the researcher's responsibility.
No, I think you're right. No, I agree with you. And in fact, I sort of feel like, what are you... I had a big think. In fact, there's a book in my rucksack called What Are Universities For? By one of my colleagues at Bristol. And I think universities are for that. I think universities are there to listen to communities. And I was really aware... I was lucky in one sense, because I was in Rotherham, which was not a university kind of place. And I remember sitting with Miles Crompton, the head of policy in Rotherham, 2 weeks before the Brexit vote. And he said that it's going to be a Leave vote. And he knew that it was going to be a Leave vote. But a lot of my colleagues in the university didn't know. And that was because the university didn't get out enough to those communities. And I think our remit as universities is to get out there. And I think the kind of projects that you're doing here and the kind of projects that we could do are very important in decentering that knowledge. And I've actually written about this in an article, I don't know if it's here, called The University is the Other, Imagined Other. It's not here, but anyway. But I think there's something about rethinking. I talk about it in this book, actually, that's coming out. Rethinking the role of the university and what the university actually could be. And I think we need to do more about that and decenter our own comfiness. So we would often have events like this event, not in the university. So this event was held in Rotherham. So although it looks a bit like a university, it was actually held in a youth centre. So we didn't hold our dissemination events in the university. So I think you're absolutely right. It's up to us.
I like that line you say, invisible hierarchy of knowledge. Mm. I think that's really true. We forget that, you know, the university, but you made the point, the university has the funding. So we get to have the control, but there's got to be a shift so that everybody gets the voice and the control, like you said. It's up to us to...
I'm just going to make a small point because it builds on what's just been said. Because we were talking about, well, how do you incorporate diverse voices in research? And we were talking about the writing up of research and how you disseminate as well. And then just drawing on I'm trying to say that researchers don't always reside in universities either, as well.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
And so for our project, two of the teachers, they were PhD, you know, one of them had a PhD in translanguaging, another one had a PhD in theatre and applied practice. And so through working, and they're out and teaching in primary schools, and so sort of working with people who are teachers, but they're also researchers and they're also practitioners, bringing those people together and sort of saying, well, they can start sort of helping to form a project. So we're just beginning to think about how do you co-write as well, and how do you bring those different voices in?
That's really, really helpful, Vicky, because, of course, Zainab herself is doing a PhD, and actually most of the research team, including now Steve Poole, the artist, more closely involved ones are now doing PhDs. And I feel a bit divided about that. I'm kind of really pleased. And I really love that model. I just think, yeah, they obviously feel they need to do PhDs. I mean, Mariam's interesting because she just carries on. But I do think there's something about that validation of that knowledge going on there.
Yeah,
But yeah, I agree with you. A lot of the researchers we work with are researchers, and they're not in universities.
Are there still any comments from a local point of view? Any of you in the back? Anything to say?
I want to hear what it's like here. I'm quite interested. Or perceptions.
How about you guys? Did you have any points?
Not really.
Okay.
Yes, of course.
So I was just wondering what you meant a few slides ago. You said that the knowledge becomes more negotiable and that you can negotiate knowledge or something. And I was wondering what you mean by that, because for me, knowledge is not negotiable.
Yeah.
It's my personal point of view.
Yeah, so this is the quote from the Department of Communities and Local Government. Generate knowledge together, which is more authentic, representative, and negotiated with communities. That's a really interesting question. That's a really good question, because what the DCLG did, and they're sitting in Whitehall, they live in London, and they came and visited us, I think, three times. And each time, there was a moment where actually we realised that they weren't used to this. They said, we never get out much, and we're not used to this. And I remember one of them saying to me, I've had the most extraordinary time. And we even held an event in London, and somebody from the Home Office came, and he said to us afterwards, that was the most extraordinary thing I've ever been to. And I was like, wow, you can't get out very much. But I think they think of the negotiation as quite a big deal, to actually talk to ordinary people. They sit with loads of, like, graphs, and they're big policy people, so they're collecting statistics, to actually speak to somebody. And I think then that negotiation, they did listen. What was very impressive is Maria O'Byrne came for the launch of our book. She's one of the authors, and she said she learned to listen differently. So what she said is, I didn't really think about the kind of deep listening you need to do. And she was very thoughtful about that. And I think she has a background quite similar to Lindsay, actually, in she's worked quite a lot in Ireland. And I think she's really interested in those issues around integration, but really needed to find out how to access knowledge. And I think the negotiation also, for me, speaks a bit of that book, Negotiation of Identities in Multilingual Contexts, which is, again, about how do you negotiate across different linguistic registers and ways of saying things. And I was very conscious of that with DCLG. They came in very middle class London and sat in a very different space, but they negotiated that quite well, and then they wrote about it here. But it was, yeah, it was quite complex as an interaction.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? We haven't heard much from over here. Yeah, let's have somebody over here. It's always fair.
Sorry, I think it's very interesting, but, you know, I'm always very much interested in these power relations, and then I was wondering who is actually talking in these meetings, whose voice is being heard here, and whose voice then is, you know, getting into the research, because I think even if you have a community and even if you think you're collaborating with the community, it's not a community. You always probably have representatives that stand somehow for these communities, and how do you make sure that also people, the voices of other people are heard?
So this is obviously, we were very concerned with that. I mean, one issue is who gets to go to the conferences. So Zeynep did actually go to a conference, which I think James and Vicky were at, which was the translanguaging conference, but she was actually really, really offended by that conference and went away saying, I'm never going to another academic conference, because it had a very, very long film clip about pigs. And she came away and said, I'm never going to anything. She found it really hard. So that was a real eye-opener. And I did try and talk to Angela about it, is that actually, if you invite a Muslim woman to an academic conference, there is an issue there about that piece of data was for her. So what I would say is that it's often the academics have to get better at thinking about what kinds of discourses they're using. I think within Rotherham, what we did do is we had a really broad group of people including Miles, who's the head of policy, and we tried to work across the communities. So if you look at the book, it's quite evenly divided between different communities and different voices. I would say that although there was a strong British Asian part, we did work quite closely with the white British communities on the ground. But what bothers me is more the academics' inability to accommodate. Like, we're about to do a co-production conference, and we'd really like communities to produce their own work. But that might mean turning our building into something very different from this. It might mean having an exhibition space. So I think it's partly about what we're not doing. So even flights and borders. I mean, I said to Zainab, please come to New York City for ARA. She said, my mother would never let me travel. Because you can't get through the US border if you're Pakistani. So I think we need to think of our own practices first and blame us before we say it's the community's fault for being, I don't know what, hard to reach or whatever. I know that's not quite your question, but I think there's something about how we have to think differently about who we are as people. And support diversity in our workforce. I'm about to go back and do a keynote for the museum sector on diversity in their workforce. And the Arts Council England's creative case for diversity says that it's us that have to change. So we represent the communities in our workforce. Academics have to be more diverse. Then the communities will trust us more. So it is quite a, you know, I do think we need to be really honest about the problems of academia as much as about communities. And then say, well, if we change ourselves, that might help communities trust us. That's a really tough answer, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I hope that was all right. That was quite political, but there we go. Hooray. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And do keep looking at all the things, because they're all really good. Yeah, you don't want to hear me swearing under my breath.
That's okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Go have your coffee. Bring your coffee along.
Kaikille korvin
after
vielä. Ihan
kaikille. Joo. Mä oon tällä. You think you've figured that now?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
Just have to short from a separate presentation, but it's
okay.
It's not showing like here.
Oh, yeah, so but I'll be able to see it. Yeah.
I don't think so.
What do you mean? Like oh, the video. Okay, sure. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Nettie. Thank you, everyone, for staying. I know it's the afternoon and we've all had lunch and we're rather tired at this point. I think you'll find that there are quite a lot of threads running across my talk and that of Kate earlier. My presentation focuses really on one project, on a team ethnography we did in four faith settings in London. But I'm going to talk about some of the same issues that Kate also raised, and some new ones, hopefully. So I guess one of the things that I want to sort of highlight in this presentation is the importance of ethnography, of doing ethnography, of spending time in the field, trying to make sense of how people learn, how people learn, how people make meaning, and how they participate in a range of cultural practices in everyday life. And this sort of little quote from Del Himes is kind of reminds us of really ethnography is not very different from what we do in our everyday lives, how we learn every day. We learn ethnographically. And this is what we do. This is what we do with all forms of learning in our everyday lives. I'm particularly interested in multi-sided team ethnography, and in a way, this is the second large ethnographic project that I participated in that involved several team members and also doing research across several sites. Eisenhardt, back in 2001, wrote a really good article called Educational Ethnography, Past, Present, and Future. You could actually download the PDF. And towards the end of the article, she calls for, if you like, the need for doing this kind of collaborative, multi-sited research. She talks about the importance of finding more collaborative ways of working with participants, something that you know, Kate illustrated very nicely. She also talks about the importance of providing more multi-voiced accounts, taking into consideration multiple perspectives, both within the research groups, but also in relation to the participants. The idea of working in teams and across sites, and finally, the importance of using interdisciplinary approaches. So I think that this kind of vision that Eisenhardt puts forth in her article, we tried in our own research project to sort of live up to this vision, if you like. So what does it mean to work in collaborative teams, and why is it important? Researchers that like Erickson and Stuhl talk about the importance of plural gazes. Eisenhardt herself talks about the idea of broadening insights and perspectives, but also working in collaborative teams is very much at the heart of becoming aware, acknowledging, recognizing the researcher's multiple positionings. And we talked about power in previous presentations and the power differentials, not only between the researchers and the participants, but also in the context of the research team. And really being attuned, if you like, to the kind of tensions and struggles and inconsistencies that come with this negotiation of knowledge, in the sense that different participants and researchers bringing in different perspectives. And ultimately, the issue that was raised towards the end of the discussion, you know, whose knowledge is this that is being represented and in what ways, and how different accounts come to shape the research process.
Also, the idea of working across sites, we found it extremely valuable, particularly in the context of our own project, looking at faith literacies. We think about faith literacies very often as something very much confined within the private domain, the domain of the home. We're actually, kind of more recently, we've been thinking about how faith literacies are actually very much intermingled with other domains. So it's not only about the faith setting, the home setting, or the religious education classes or the places of worship, but actually trying to look at literacies and languages and identities across these different sites. So we look at cultural forms, we understand cultural forms as being quite mobile rather than rooted to specific locales. And then, of course, the idea of working across sites also highlights the importance of drawing connections and interconnections across sites, and how local, if you like, sites are linked to global and translocal processes and practices. So this is our project. It was called Becoming Literate in Faith Settings, Language and Literacy Learning in the Lives of New Londoners. It was funded by ESRC. And we looked at these four different faith communities. The reason, really, that we embarked on this project was from a somewhat peripheral role that faith plays in educational research. So it's not an area that has attracted a lot of attention, and very often the kind of attention that attracts is probably more negative. So we actually wanted to start from the communities themselves. We had links with these communities. Colleagues who became our co-researchers, worked with us on the project, had either done their masters or PhDs at Goldsmiths. So we had established contacts with these communities well before we started on the research project. And we also wanted to look at more recent migration to London. So these communities have really, their numbers have picked up post Second World War. And these are the sort of questions that we wanted to explore in our project. So as you can see, we started from a kind of broad understanding of literacy and literacy practices and what is their nature and scope. We were also interested in the teaching and learning that takes place during faith activities. But also, we wanted to take an intergenerational perspective and look at how faith practices might have changed over time and in the London setting, and what it meant to the grandparents and what it meant to the children, and how these perceptions have changed or not. And then also, we wanted to link faith, the development of faith literacies with how children develop their individual and collective identities. Sort of just, I've got one slide just to sort of situate you a little bit in the theoretical, if you like, framework that we used. We looked at faith as cultural practice. We also recognized the uniqueness of faith learning. So unlike other forms of learning, particularly school learning, or learning associated with school literacies, the kind of knowledge, competencies, and performances that children and young people learn and perfect over time are a means to building a relationship with a higher being. So this is what, you know, is quite unique in terms of faith learning. However, as I mentioned earlier, faith literacies are often seen as either are often regarded, if you like, seen as invisible, or they're considered problematic in relation to school literacies. So the kind of broad theoretical approach that we took was one shaped by sociocultural approaches to language, literacy, and learning, sort of looking at trying to start from the sociocultural and historical context of children's learning, and then look at how they were participating in culturally significant activities of their faith communities, and how these cultural practices were mediated through language, but also through other semiotic resources. And this is our team, the beliefs team, the photo. And just, you know, as you can see, we were 11 researchers coming from different disciplinary backgrounds, also different linguistic and cultural backgrounds, which inevitably brought in different positionings and sort of dynamics within the team. And more importantly, different kinds of knowledge. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, how as a research team, we try to develop a way to have a continuous conversation about the different forms of knowledge that we were bringing in and how we were using that knowledge not only to share our own experiences, but also make sense of in many cases, for many of us, entering a new linguistic and cultural context. So for many of us, you know, some of us may not have gone, for instance, to a mosque or visited a temple before in our lives. So we were also kind of going through the same kind of learning process as members of the team. And certainly, the way that we were trying to make sense of this of these new faith settings made us develop strong reflexivity, and if you like, turn our gaze towards ourselves. Think about how our own religious or non-religious beliefs shaped the way that we were engaging with the participants, working with them, and sort of trying to understand their faith practices. We were very fortunate to get funding for 3 years, 3.5 years for this project. From the beginning, we wanted the project to be participatory and intergenerational, so working with our participants. And we also used different methods for data collection. So we started off with ethnographic observations in the different faith settings, in the religious education classes, and then we moved to work with 4 children per site, so 16 children altogether over a period of 2 years, using different kinds of linguistic as well as visual research methods, and I'll talk about this in a bit. I'll give you a couple of examples of the kind of research methods that we developed. These are our participants. We have a website. A lot of the data that we collected are on the website. It's an open access website. You can consult it and use it for your teaching as well. Now, there are some challenges doing research in faith settings. Faith settings are considered as sensitive settings. I briefly said earlier that very often faith is considered a very private part of life. So how do you go into somebody's home and you start recording a prayer? In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I went to a conference in Cologne, and I showed a prayer, a child praying, and one of the participants was shocked, and she said to me, I mean, how could you do that? How could you show somebody? So I had to explain that the way that we worked with the research in the homes is that we actually gave all the recording equipment to the families and the children. And we asked them to record for us whatever they felt comfortable. So if they felt comfortable sharing a prayer, to go ahead and record it. But if they didn't feel comfortable with it, then they didn't record it. So it was, you know, that was kind of the way that we negotiated. And also we tried to go to the homes about once a month and kind of touch base with the families. But we did not find it appropriate to actually hang around as people performed their kind of everyday faith-related rituals. But then we also tried to collect data from the children, collect some data through scrapbooks, which was a completely different way of working with the children. But in terms of the recorded data, we gave the equipment to the families to record for us. So again, the idea that how do you deal with how do you make your research not be intrusive, insensitive, or disrespectful? So this was something that we were constantly thinking about as we were doing the research. When you go into, and I think one of our co-researchers, Arani, puts it quite aptly, if you like. She herself was born and brought up in London, Tamil Hindu background. And she says, so when I go into the temple, when I usually go to the temple to pray, but now I'm going to the temple as a researcher. So when I'm in the temple, how can I manage to pray and do research at the same time? Which I think really kind of brings out the multiplicity of roles that we have. And you can't necessarily separate the one from the other. And then finally, the idea very much associated with faith is that only if you're a member of the faith community, you can actually understand the rituals. You can feel, you know, the sort of this connection, if you like, that is being built, that is being developed, built over time with an eternal being. So if you're not a member of the faith community, what happens then? Can you not sort of make sense of the practices? So the examples from the project I'm going to show you come from one particular community. That's the community that I worked with more closely. And So I said earlier that one of the methodologies that we developed was the idea of using scrapbooks. So what we did was we gave these A4 blank notebooks to the children, and we gave them a very open-ended remit. We said you can stick, write, draw, paint, whatever you want in those books that have to do with your faith. So, you know, it was up to the children to interpret how they would represent and talk about their faith experiences in these books. And they did this project over a year. And once a month, when the researcher would go into the home, would sort of ask, so how are you getting along with the scrapbook? Some kids were very enthusiastic and produced masses of work. Others were a lot less enthusiastic. But overall, it worked quite well. There were several reasons why we chose this particular methodology. Again, we were very much concerned about issues around power and agency. We talked earlier in the morning about the imbalance between the adult researcher and the child participants, and what can we do to... You can never get rid of it, but how can we, first of all, be aware of it, and secondly, find ways to minimize it? And sort of giving the children this opportunity to write, draw, paint for us without really giving them a set task, you know, this is what you need to do. We sort of felt that we were giving them this possibility of, you know, doing it, but also not doing it, because some didn't do that much. So, you know, going back to Kate's point about kids saying no, you know, we can't force them to do the scrapbook if they don't want to. And I think, you know, they have the right to decide whether and how much they want to invest in this. But also the idea of viewing children as knowledgeable. So the kids we worked with were, the youngest were 6 when we started, and the oldest were around 12. So the age range was quite wide, if you like. It was, we came from, if you like, an understanding of children as knowledgeable, as active and creative agents and meaning makers, if you like. And we wanted to listen to their voices. And we also found this as a different way, the scrapbooks as a different way to produce knowledge. And if you like, a different way to document their multilingual, multi-scriptal and other resources. And finally, it was part of our research methodology. We actively encouraged verbal ways of sharing, not verbal and visual, so not just verbal. For instance, when we did the interviews with the children, we used the mind maps, the idea that they could actually draw and represent visually their kind of life experiences. And you can see all the mind maps that the children created during their interviews on the website. Yes, and then again, I think another important point that we've kind of talked about today is the whole idea of how do we go about building collaborative relations and trust, and particularly when you're working you're working on a topic like faith, which is a very personal and sensitive one. How do you make sure that you develop these kind of relationships? We were very, I think perhaps it's quite telling that all the families stayed with us throughout the duration of the project. So I think, and they felt very comfortable to allow their children's videos and text making to be posted on an open access website. So I think that is perhaps, that says something about the kind of relationships we were able to build over time. This is some of the children's text making and some of the pictures they took for us. I'll just show you a couple of slides, and then I'll just give you. This is from the inside of the temple. It's from one of the celebrations. It's called the education ceremony, and then there's a representation of the goddess that you see in the photo by one of the children. This is an annual event, the chariot ceremony, that takes place outside the temple. And people from the neighborhood also come and watch, not only people from the faith community, and then how a child represents the chariot festival. And this is from inside the temple. And I just want to show you just these kind of two entries. This is from Xanthia's scrapbook. And the title of her entry was, Why do Hindus consider Om sacred? And she did a representation of the Tamil Om. So this is Tamil, and it means Om. And this is the representation of Om, which is a sacred sound in Hinduism, in Sanskrit. And then she found this information from a book, and she produced this kind of information text where she talks about why Om is considered sacred. So after the children completed the scrapbooks, they sat with the researcher and they kind of went through the scrapbook page by page, and they talked about what they had drawn, what they had written, and we did this if you like activity because we wanted to hear from the children, you know, how they had designed these scrapbooks and what meanings they wanted to sort of highlight. And I've got a little clip, so I'm sorry, I have to get out of the this one. Okay, so this is a small clip where the researcher is talking to the children about this particular entry that I showed you. Okay.
A lovely literary Tamil Om, and you explain about Om. Did you get this from the book as well? That's in here.
Okay, so
explain to me, why
do we have a Tamil Om?
Why do we have a different Om to this Om?
Do you agree? Like, do you feel the same things when you chant Om?
Yeah, it's like sense vibrations.
Yeah, it's like, is it? What about you, Chandu? Do you feel the same?
Calming kind of sound.
Yeah?
Relaxing.
Yeah. So, do you get taught sort of meditation?
Okay. So, I just wanted to show you a little clip. I think what probably characterized. Go back.
It's not from current slide.
It's okay. Sorry. Sorry. Yes. So I just wanted to give you an idea of how these interviews with the children worked after the after they completed the scrapbooks. And so the idea was to kind of go beyond what they had written on the text, in the text, and use their text making to get them to talk a little bit about their faith, about their religious practices, kind of get their perspectives that perhaps, or in addition to what they had written or drawn for their text making. And you can see how these children talk about how, if you like, they recontextualize their understanding of Om, what it means for them in terms of their own religious experiences. And also, I think what's quite interesting is how Arani, who's doing these interviews, there's a lot of co-construction going on. She is a member of the faith community. There's a lot of back-channeling, a lot of very, very supportive, if you like, turn-taking taking place. So one of the important issues that was raised by others as well today was the idea of, you know, ethnographers' responsibilities and representation. So whose voices get to be represented? And Kate raised the point earlier about the need of to find new ways of writing in collaborative team ethnography. And I'll talk to you a little bit about how we as a team tried to address that. So we worked in pairs. So there were two researchers in each of the faith communities. So there was a dialogue, an ongoing dialogue between the pairs. And then we met as a group once a month. And we sort of talked about how the fieldwork was going and what sort of things that we were observing. So there was sort of these two levels of dialogue going on at the same time, if you like, between the pairs, but also within the team, the broader team. And one of the ways that we tried to do to make these dialogues was through writing what we called field narratives. So the idea of field narratives came from the idea of actually making our field notes more, having a stronger narrative quality. There were, if you like, the spaces where we were able to share and discuss what we were observing. So we kind of set out in this research paper we did with Eve and colleagues some of the kind of key components. How do we understand field narratives? So we thought about them in terms of representing a well-formed piece of writing. We included poems, prayers, or other significant moments within these narratives. We also wanted to include the emotions experienced by the researchers in these narratives. Also, see them as a space where researchers could reflect on their personal memories, either as members of a particular faith community or as somebody who is new to the faith community. And also we use these field narratives, if you like, in a dialogic way, so sharing them and talking about them together as a group. So I'm going to show you a few examples of just very short bits from these field narratives to give you a little flavor of how we sought to engage in dialogue and knowledge building among the members of the team. And one of the first things we did as a team was to visit each other's sites. So we were all working within a particular site, but we all made a point to go and visit the other faith settings. So when we did that, some of the things that came out from the field narrative, these initial field narratives of visiting each other's sites, was what was unique for each faith setting, but also what were the common features. You'll also see a lot of comparison across the research sites, and then how, by comparing the new with the known, how we became more aware of our own sites. And finally, on the different connections across the sites. So this is, I'm going to show you four, these are the beginning, almost sort of the beginning of four field narratives. This was written by Arani, who was introduced to you earlier. So this is her sort of introductory paragraph to visiting the Murugan Temple, which was the faith setting for the Tamil Hindu community, faith community. So do you just read it very quickly and I'll show the others. I think that what's really interesting about these field narratives is also for us to observe what each researcher notices and what they comment on. You know, what do we observe? So our noticings are very personal. They're infused by our own experiences, migration experiences, educational experiences, interests. So if you could just take a minute and read this. Everybody has read it. Shall I move on? Yeah? This is the second one by myself. So for me, this was the second time in the temple. So I was very observant. I was paying attention to what Arani was doing and trying to kind of follow her lead, if you like. Upon entering the temple, there are certain rituals that need to be done. So I actually felt very comfortable to do it. But you'll see later on that one of the researchers didn't feel that way and didn't decided not to do it. Can I move on? Yeah? So this is the third one. Malgosa Woodham was working with a Polish Catholic faith community. And this is kind of the introductory, almost introductory paragraph to her field narrative when she visited the temple with Arani. Okay, and I'll show you the last one. Haliman worked with the Bangladeshi Muslim faith community, and this is also her first visit. Her first visit ever to a temple. She's never been to a temple. As I said earlier, what I find really interesting is what we each notice and what we each talk about. So is there anything that you would like to comment on these four different versions of the same event, if you like, entering into a Hindu temple? Has anyone been to a Hindu temple? Anyone? Raise your hands. One, two, three. Okay. All right. It's quite an experience. Not very different from entering a Gothic church, as Margosa, or going to a Greek Orthodox church in terms of splendor and the sense of awe and beauty. Any thoughts about these field narratives?
Well, I think this is interesting how it's all about clothing. Whereas the other one was about the action.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the touching and the doing.
So I just think it's interesting what we notice. It might say nothing about them, but it's, you know, do you notice the actions you do before or what people are wearing?
Yeah.
So I think that's a whole multi-sensory, like how we have
absolutely
to observe,
you know? I mean, that's precisely one of the things that we found with the faith literacy project, that even though we sort of started off with an interest in language, that you cannot just look at language on its own. You need to look at the whole package, if you like. The way that all communicative resources work together.
Yeah. And sometimes as ethnographers, we forget about the smells and
yes,
the sounds.
That's why you have to visit a temple. You have, you know, to actually get a sense, and we've got other descriptions from the field narratives where you really get the sense of the bells ringing, you know, the chanting that goes on, the drum, there's drumming at some point. It's a very, I mean, I grew up as a Greek Orthodox. If you go to a Greek Orthodox church, there's a liturgy. It starts at this time, ends at that time. Yeah. You know, that's quite specific. Yes, there's a lot of that as well. You know, smells. But, you know, going into a temple, there's lots of things happening at the same time. There's no one key religious ritual happening exclusively, unless it's for a particular religious ceremony. So it's a very different experience. So it's definitely worth visiting. Any other thoughts?
Okay, I just have one question, because in the end she says, I watch her as she does this, but unfortunately do not take part. But you took part, even though you're also not...
Yes.
So, did she not take part because she thinks that's against her own religion?
Yeah, we had this. Yes.
Regrets it because
no, because
because she says unfortunately she could also just say but do not take part. I don't know.
Yeah, we actually talked about that, and Haliman was very reluctant to actually even enter the temple. She felt that it just didn't sit well with her own religious identity, and. But then in the end, she decided that, you know, she would come along and visit it. But yes, that's I think she just didn't feel comfortable participating as a Muslim woman to actually, I didn't feel the same way. I'm very comfortable in places of worship, you know, so, but I understand that some people may not be. Also, people with non-religious beliefs, you know, may not wish to participate. Yeah. Just maybe I'll just show you. I talked about the dialogue. So we talk about in this paper about three levels, the dialogue happening across three levels. So there's an intrapersonal dialogue, so a dialogue with the self, an interpersonal interactive dialogue, so between the researchers. And then, if you like, a broader dialogue of this, which has to do with the socio-historical and political context, using documentation, but also contextualizing the site historically and socially. And I think Haliman's comment at the beginning of her narrative, where she observes the neighborhood and says, you know, even though I'm coming to a site of worship that I don't necessarily, you know, want to participate in terms of, you know, the practices, I feel very comfortable with this neighborhood because there's so many women that are dressed like me. So I think this is kind of the broader socio-historical context that we were also trying, and the dialogue of between the researcher and this broader socio-historical context. Yes, and then just I have some... kind of concluding thoughts and questions to think about. So we used field narratives as a way to co-construct our understanding of rich and complex repertoires of languages, literacies, and identities across these different sites. And we also used it as a means to continuously reflect on our own positionings as researchers. And I think it is important to remember that, you know, as researchers, many times we ourselves are new into languages, cultures, communities, religions. So we are also in the process of learning and becoming socialized into new practices. And that disturbs, if you like, disrupts the imbalances between my majority and minority, the academic and the sort of non-academic. So questions to think about, how do we teach and learn from one another? How do we go about translating our own faith practices or our developing understandings of new faith practices to other team members and the outside world? So this translation, ongoing translation process. And how might we bring our own religious or non-religious beliefs to bear on the ethnographic process? So these are sort of questions to think about, but specifically for faith settings, but, you know, they might be relevant in doing research in other settings as well. So, yes, I don't know if we have any questions or any thoughts.
Thank you. That was very interesting. I just had also the similar question that would also be a question to the previous presentation, because now we've mostly talked about how to collect data, how to mm-hmm. include the voices. But then I was still wondering, because you also said, you know, you have these very multimodal representations. Mm-hmm. You use the term semiotic resources. And then I was thinking, how do we actually, and that was actually a question also asked the last time, how do we interpret these resources? What kind of methodologies or methods do we actually use, apply? And mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. that's just mm-hmm. a question. Yeah. I mean, yeah. you can always sit down with people and ask them, yeah, what did you draw here? But I think texts themselves, they might have so many layers of
Absolutely.
Meaning.
Yeah, yes. that yeah.
have to be taken yeah. into consideration.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think theoretically, I said earlier that we started from a sort of broader sociocultural approach to language literacy and learning, looking at faith as a cultural practice. We've used ideas that Kate and her colleagues have developed around artifactual literacies or syncretic literacies, so how these different threads of knowledge, of experience, of history come together in the children's text making. So kind of theoretically, that's the kind of lens that we've used. Then methodologically, you know, I think there's, you know, we're trying to collect different kinds of data to illuminate the same questions. So, you know, trying to, and I think there's a value in doing a longitudinal ethnography. You can afford to have ongoing conversations and to develop the kind of richer understandings that perhaps you can't if you go in for a week, do the recordings, take them home, and write it up. I think we could have done more in terms of talking and sort of developing a dialogue, you know, with the children and the families. At the end of every year, we had, and Kate came to those as well, we had an advisory, we called them advisory group meetings, but actually what they were kind of inviting the families and the faith leaders and some academics to sort of come together, and we talked about, you know, some of the things that we were observing, and we tried to get the perspectives of the participants themselves. So that was an additional kind of source of knowledge sharing. But these activities are built, you know, in the project and over time. It's not something that you kind of do, you know, in a really short project. And then at the end, we had a big sort of knowledge sharing event where all the families came over. Perhaps it did have more of a celebratory character. But I think it's also important for people to feel that their faith literacies are validated. So, you know, I've in the past, people, members of the audience have asked me, you know, well, this is not critical, the kind of work. But we did not set up to do, you know, a critical, if you like, to take a critical approach to faith literacies. The families we worked with were actually very observant. You know, we did not choose to work with families who, for instance, have left the faith, because that's another category altogether, or families who were questioning their faith identities. The people who wanted to participate in this project were actually very much active in their faith community. So in a way, it kind of goes back to the question we said earlier, whose voices get to be represented here? Well, you know, it's particular families who are very much engaged with their faith, and their children were very much engaged. So there is a limitation to the kind of claims that we can make. But we're not claiming that, you know, this is representative of all Hindu, you know, Tamil Hindu communities either. So it's always, you know, we have to strike a balance, I guess. It's very difficult. I think we need to be clear about who our participants are and where they're coming from. And this was not a project on, you know, religious belief. We did not say, do you believe in God? That was not the the point of the project either. We do recognize that, you know, one of the issues that we wanted to explore, and we never sort of got around to it because of different constraints, primarily because the children went to different schools, because they were in different boroughs in London, was sort of to see what happens when, if faith literacies ever travel into the mainstream school, what happens there? So are they ever seen as a resource? And there's now a little bit of work that's being developed around that, particularly in the US there's been a little bit of work, which is quite interesting, but it's a really centers around Catholic schools or Jewish schools, so schools that have a religious, if you like, orientation. So what can faith literacies become a resource? The same way that we talk about culture and language being a resource in schools. Can faith be a resource? And if so, in what ways? But that requires thinking about our own religious and non-religious beliefs and also taking into consideration, you know, the religious and non-religious beliefs of children and families. So it's a, yeah. That was a long answer. Yes, sorry.
Has to be a quick one, yeah.
Does this work? Yeah. As a follow-up question to that, like, it's sort of like a short, like a meta type of question. Like, did you have to, in your research, because you talked about how sensitive this topic is,
yes,
and then how people think that you have to be critical. So did you have to kind of, in the research, actually state that it is not like any sort of a political statement or any sort of a critical approach? Because I feel like a lot of people expect it from a research that focuses on, you know, religious topics. Or do you just kind of let the, you know, like correct people as they come and then kind of let it work out that way? Or do you have to actually address it, like say, like, we are not here to do this with it, like it's not about
not,
it?
Not in the research proposal, but definitely in presentations. You know, when we present the work, you know, we've had to defend it, you know, and say, you know, why we're not taking a critical perspective.
Yeah, do you think it's necessary to kind of state it in the research itself, or is it enough to kind of like just do it in the post?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about it. I think you need to situate, we situated our research within educational research. So we found a gap. There's a gap in the literature. There's a particular positioning and very prevalent discourse around faith literacies in education. So we situated the work there in that sort of field, if you like. But no, we did not really, you know, talk about that. It was not one of the research questions, if you like.
Yeah.
And it was not sort of the aim of the research. The aim of the research was to look at language and literacy learning in London. That was, you know, from the participants' perspectives.
Yeah.
That was kind of the aim of the research, and we were very clear about that.
Yeah, it just sounded like from your answer that some people, they still thought that it would be something.
Yes,
critical.
I mean, as I said, this happens when we present it. It's always a topic that kind of, you know, gets some animated discussion going. So,
yeah, and that's another thing. Maybe this sort of research then helps people realize that it doesn't always have to be that way. Like, you get so much more out of religious context than just, you know, the religious talk, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I've been invited to do a talk in France, and the person who invited me at the University of Strasbourg said to me, well, you have to explain why it's important to study faith literacies, because in France it's a secular country. So, you know, religion is for the home. We don't want to hear about it. We don't want to see it. You know, visually, you can't wear a cross, you can't wear a skull cup, you know, that's the way it is. It's a secular society, there's separation. So you actually need to start your presentation by arguing very forcefully why it is necessary as a teacher to engage with this discussion, rather than sort of, you know, thinking that you can leave it at the classroom door. The same way we leave race, ethnicity, language at the classroom door, you need to leave religion alongside. So I thought, well, I said, okay, I'll do that. So I think you need to think about, again, the sociocultural context and the historical context. And, you know, it's very important, particularly when you talk about faith.
Yeah, so you have to think about it inside the research and then when you present the research.
Absolutely, yeah. I never anticipated that it would be, you know, for me, you know, as I said, I grew up as a Greek Orthodox, and, you know, I'm not the sort of person that goes to church regularly at all, but it's, you know, going into church is a very normal thing. So so it has actually challenged a lot of my own assumptions. You know, I thought it was something, you know, very normal. But, you know, maybe it's not for some other people. So it's also, you know, becoming more reflexive as a researcher and sort of, you know, rethinking about things that you took for granted. I think that was a big lesson for me.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anyway, thank you very much. Thanks.